hijinks in the state legislature were coming to a head just as COVID-19 became a national emergency, depriving the state of a normal working legislative session at the start of the crisis. So yeah, I think you might recall that when basically our legislators fled to other states like Idaho, so Republican legislators, so that a quorum could not be established at the state legislature to actually address these cap and trade votes. And so that was an interesting moment. And also another moment in at the local level here, at the state level here in Oregon, that demonstrates the divide that is happening right now across the country. And were you aware? Hello. Were you aware of the corporate funding behind Timber Union?
She's gone. She's not on air anymore.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you. All right. Well, I would once again thank you so much for your call. I'd really like to encourage other folks to call in as well. The timber unity elements here in Oregon, I definitely want to take a closer look at that. Once again, this is American Standoff, and we're a call-in talk radio show, so please feel free to call in. Today we are discussing Mitch McConnell's comments last week after blocking the passage of the voting rights legislation, and basically saying that Black Americans are not Americans.
We're out of time.
We're out of time? Oh, yeah. Sorry. Okay. Thank you so much. I guess I had run late. I hadn't realized that. This is Jacqueline Keeler and this is American Standoff, and I'd like to thank all of you who called in, and we'll be back next week and to take a closer look at these issues of political division in this country.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m.
Yes, the Veterans Tap Dance Administration proudly takes you forward into the past.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. Just about 2 years ago, BP, before the pandemic, I had the great pleasure of welcoming to KBOO four of the very best short fiction writers in Portland, in the whole country, for that matter. Margaret Malone, author of People Like You, which was a Penn Hemingway finalist. Kimberly King Parsons, whose book Blacklight was long listed for a 2019 National Book Award. Karen Russell, author of Orange World and recipient of both the MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellowship, and Lydia Yuknovich, author of the story collection Verge, which was at the time just a week away from its pub date. Lydia's previous books have garnered numerous awards and honors, and my KBOO colleague David Naiman calls her Portland's literary fairy godmother. This episode is one of my very favorites and also one of the last ones we recorded live in the KBOO studios before COVID shut the place down and we all started doing radio from home. Ah, the good old days. So please join us as we travel forward into the past for our January 2020 conversation with Margaret, Kim, Karen, and Lydia, which is already in progress. Margaret, Karen, Kim, and Lydia, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Now, I'm looking around the table and having an almost out-of-body experience. I can't believe you're all here. It's such an incredible group of immense talent, intelligence, and heart. So just very grateful for that. While I'm happy just to sit here and stare and pinch myself, I don't think it's going to work well on radio. So since for all of you, your most recent book is a story collection, I'd like to make this somewhat of a master class in short fiction. I don't think all four of you have been together like this, but you've been paired up in several events. Margaret, when People Like You came out, Lydia blurbed the book. She called it the biggest mouth-to-mouth resuscitation of storytelling I've seen in years. And she also hosted you at your Powell's book launch. And thanks to YouTube. I heard you read the story, yes, from the book.
Oh, yeah.
But the conversation, unfortunately, wasn't recorded. So I was wondering, it was a few years ago, but do you remember anything that particularly sticks out about your conversation with Lydia then?
You know, the thing that still stuck with me is Lydia was the first person to ask me about class in the stories, which is something that I think had been a subtext of all the stories, of everything I probably have ever written and never knew. It was even subtextual to me in a way. And Lydia was the first person that asked about that. And as soon as she did, it became this like more conscious beacon for me in a really wonderful way.
Has that influenced your current work then? Just being a little more conscious of class? And I've seen that too in people like you.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I don't know that I have enough distance from the next collection yet to know how much, how more obvious it is now. But I just know that I was aware of it in a different way in the writing of it. I don't know that I have distance yet enough to know on the other side of it. Yeah.
And Kim, you and Karen appeared together in your home state a few months ago. And that was for a talk at the Texas Book Festival. It was called Sojourns in the Shadows, Short Fiction That Isn't Afraid of the Dark, which I think applies to every writer in this room. And you've been compared to Karen in several of the reviews of Blacklight. Here's one from the LA Times. I don't know if you've read this, Karen. Parsons is an exhilarating, enchanting, charming, and irresistible new voice. Imagine the punk rock stylings of the criminally underappreciated Jeff Parker, and the full-throated roar of weird Karen Russell. And then the review goes on to mention a few others. Very good company. But I was wondering if Karen's work was an influence on Blacklight, and what do you think you share? Is it that full-throated roar of weirdness?
100% Karen's work is influential to my work. And we were at Columbia. I was a year behind you, and I sort of saw her. The back of her, she was like rushing through. I could see her work, and I was following her since then. But for me, the thing that I've taken from Karen's work is humor, probably most of all. Just having narrators who are able and happy to point out when things are ridiculous, or just to be light in that way, to sort of undercut those sort of more transcendent moments with like the next beat can be funny, like that's okay to do. That was definitely something I took from you from all those times ago.
Yeah, it's a really wild thing. I mean, I read Kim's work for the first time this year, but it's funny, I think this happens that, you know, we think of like influence as it can sound so kind of linear and vertical in time, but I think like in writing world, it's sort of like butterfly generations. It's happening at such a velocity, and it's happening laterally, and that applies to everybody in this room. That, you know, and I, in Kim's work now, I just felt like they were memories being returned to my body. I've been living in Texas teaching, and but you know, don't have a lot of terrestrial experience there, and this the landscape and this the human landscape too, and everything about Kim's sibling stories, and particular just the slow stickiness of child time, and the weirdness of that threshold where you're watching people metamorphose. You know, you're watching your older siblings, you know, becoming something else before your eyes. Everything that's deeply uncanny about that, about family, I just like really connected to. And I'm so glad that review favorably and wasn't like at her worst. Kim Parsons.
Weird Karen Russell. Oh, just one quick aside. There's Kim, you were born in Lubbock, Texas. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Buddy Holly story, and Lydia, you actually mentioned that in one of your stories. I just
I
read that.
Yes, I know that. Well, first I have to try not to crumple, because I'm as thrilled as you are to be at this table with these women. I have so much awe for all of your talent and brilliance and beauty. Sorry, had to get that out. I went to college at Texas Tech, and I have climbed the Buddy Holly statue in a drunken stupor.
Amazing. I love that.
Not that tall, is it?
No, it's pretty short, but I felt like it was incredibly high, and I had accomplished a great feat. But your stories really resonate with me, both of you. My mother was born in Texas, and I went to college there. My first husband was from Texas, and I know your work isn't all about Texas or anything, but there are little moments where all the writers I love, we have these strange nexes or crisscrossing places that make me vibrate. I love it.
Now, I wanted to get to something, Karen. When we did a previous interview for Orange World, it was a few months ago. You were about 6 months pregnant at the time.
Yeah.
I found this quote from you, and this will get into the short story part of the show, which hopefully take us through the rest of the hour. Stories feel special to me because each can become a kind of universe in miniature. As a kid, I loved snow globes and museum dioramas, maybe for the same reason. I also think stories can haunt you in a very particular way. Their velocity and their compactness, I always have the sense, too, with my favorite stories, that the world of the story is still spinning somewhere long after I finish the last page. Because of a story's brevity, you could almost hold it in the palm of your hand. You can walk around its periphery. It stays with you in a different way, I think, than a novel. A story can work on you almost like a poem. You read it in one sustained burst, and it has a different kind of integrity inside you. And Margaret, I wanted to add one quote that I found from you in there, too. Short stories are my primary form and favorite form to work in because they're the closest in shape and freedom of language and brevity, that word again, to how I see the world and prefer to live in it. So this is for everybody at the table. Could you all talk about what attracts you to the short story form?
I think for me it's something about intensity of voice, and not that you can't have that in a longer piece, but generally with a short story, you're getting in quick, you're getting the reader to where they need to be right away. And so there's this sort of compression that's happening at the sentence level, but also the scenes are compressed. There's, you know, the tendency in a novel, I'm working on a novel now, and it's just, how do we extend and prolong and unpack? And I have the opposite instinct in short stories, which is, how do we get in and cut straight to the bone quick, as fast as possible? So that's what I like about them, is that sort of intensity and how you can sit down, and I have the same feeling that Karen said in the quote that you read, about this feeling that you're sort of looking in on a world that's complete without you, and then it's going to go on after you've left. Whereas there's something about a novel that feels like you're really getting the whole scope of it, but with a short story, it's like just this perfect little piece.
Yeah, I love that too, just that keyhole feeling, and my favorite stories have that sense where there's something cruel about stories sometimes. I think they're not everybody's bag. I
sure.
Definitely have friends and relatives who are like, finish the goddamn story, you know? Because you're sometimes leaving people on a real emotional plateau, or, you know, I feel like in some of Kim's stories, it's like this painful music is gonged inside your body, and then now it's over to you, you know, mm-hmm. to live in those reverberations. And I heard Mary Gateskill in a Q&A once, I guess she said, you know, people were sort of upset. They were like, well, we want resolution. We want to know basically how to feel about what you've presented us with. And she was like, well, if you can't be responsible for your feelings, you won't be responsible for your actions, you know, basically, not to paraphrase Mary Gateskill badly. Mm-hmm. But I just sort of, there is something, the demand of a story can be high, I think, for readers, because sometimes it is just that mystery of a personality or the mystery of a moment. Or I love what, in the other quote, just this idea that the day in shards, and you're going to examine this one shard and have the opportunity to really slow down and see it from all angles in a way that's rarely possible in sort of the onrush of life. And in a novel sometimes too, I think the onrush of plot, sometimes you kind of get swept forward. There's this real momentum, which is so pleasurable, but maybe less permission to go clause to clause and beat to beat and really examine something.
I love that idea of the ruthlessness of a story, because when Ken, you first asked that question, I had this very concise visual image of, I have these two kids that are 6 and 8, and they are at this brief age where they play together, and mm-hmm. play is a word, I don't know how to use it in any other way, because I don't know, I wouldn't call it playing, but basically they'll just like drag each other down the hallway screaming, and like sometimes they'll think it's fun,
that
and sometimes
like
they
story.
Won't.
Yeah.
And
has
I
has
feel
a duck,
like.
Duck, rock.
Exactly. Yeah. But for
but
me,
they
like.
Rocks at each other.
That's what a short story mm-hmm. is. It's like you get to drag the reader yeah. down the hallway, and like sometimes they love it, and it's a really good time, and sometimes they're like, I want this to stop. But whatever that is, like maybe it's the control freak in me, like mm-hmm. that aspect of story writing is the best.
now, Lydia, in Verge, in one of the stories I can't get out of my head is The Organ Runner, about an abandoned 8-year-old girl in an unnamed Eastern European country, and oh man, it's just a terrible existence. She becomes part of a ring of human organ harvesters, kind of like an Oliver Twist, but with no hint of a sentimentality or salvation in that story. It's only about 17 pages, but back to Karen's quote, you create a universe in miniature in just those 17 pages, and the story haunts the reader, it haunted me at least, in that very particular way, Karen, that you mentioned. What are some of the ways you achieve that in a short story? which might not work well in a novel. And you've written both, short fiction and novels.
Well, I was listening intently to the novel part. I'm still trying to figure out how to write novels, so I took some notes while Karen was talking.
You've done a pretty good job in the past.
But I'm working on it. I'm always working. Like, what is it? What is a novel is still a question for me. But in relation to your question, I think of short stories slightly differently in that I think they're like parallel universes, only we don't know very much about them yet. And so when you say they're different worlds or like microcosms of something, to me they are. Like you went through a little portal mm-hmm. and you get to live in this parallel universe for a very short amount of time. And then when I was listening, it's fascinating to me because though I came out of the tradition and inherited the same forms as everybody else at the table, I think I've spent the last 20 years trying to undo what I learned. And so I write in literary fragments, period. And sometimes those fragments find a place to resolve or a place to hold a tension open, and those are short stories. And sometimes those fragments go on and on in my work, and they turn into novels. And I'm not abandoning plot as we've inherited it traditionally, but I'm scratching at it and seeing if there's another way to define plot mm-hmm. by and through an emotional intensity or a short set of links. And so, as usual, I just see it slightly differently, but it's related to everyone else, I promise. But I experience it sitting there maybe a little differently.
Well, why don't we talk about that, the novel versus the short story? Karen, you actually took a short story, and this was Ava Wrestles the Alligator in your first collection, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves. And you expanded that into your novel, Swamplandia. What were the reasons for that? I think I asked you when we talked before, what if you took The Gondoliers, a story in here which, Lydia, I think you'd love if you haven't read it already.
Okay. I love all of them.
About two girls kind of almost mutating to adapt to this post-apocalyptic world, this flooded water world. What made you adapt this short story into Swamplandia? Was it the characters? You didn't feel you got the story out in that short piece?
Just quickly to bow before Lydia, because I thought The Book of Joan, I just adore this novel, and it's I'm sure that was percolating for me when I was imagining this.
I feel completely related to you
world.
In a very strange way.
Yeah, that's is it. We'll have to do some I don't know, astral travel, figure it out. It is so funny. I feel like that is another funny way that lineage works, that you start to meet people who you have similar reading histories, or you have like the same like literary godparents or something, and you get to meet them when you read their work. I don't know. I cannot recommend, this will be my PSA for our summit, I can't recommend taking a short story and then making it into a novel. Only a fool would think that was the way to go. As I learned, I mean, I'm happy that it exists now, but I think my great delusion was, hey, I know I loved those characters, and I just kept, it was sort of like the literary fragment. It didn't necessarily have a plot that was driving it, but it just kept growing like kudzu. So I had this like kudzu sprawl, which I believed would just sort of on its own become a novel, the way that like moss grows in Portland or whatever. Yeah. You know, I was like, oh, it's happening. And I bet in one summer's time, this will have, you know, I think I had like a very diluted idea about what a novel was. And I still don't know. I still don't know what a novel is. It makes much less sense to me, I think, than a story where there you sort of feel like here's something that's bounded and I can ricochet and play within this corral. I've corralled something, I've cordoned off some space, and I'm going to explore it. Whereas with a novel, nothing feels cordoned off to me, and it seems like you could just like wander in the snow and die there and never reach a resting place. So it's a scarier endeavor for me, and that is how that book felt, and I'm happy to have made it out of the swamp, but I did spend most of my 20s in like an imaginary swamp of the mind. But I loved those characters was the answer, Ken. I think they did continue to haunt me in a way that I felt I owed those sisters and, you know, and their brother kind of a chaperone through that kind of emotional, literal swamp.
Now, Kim, you mentioned you're working on a novel now, and famously it's about motherhood, Texas, and LSD.
the big three.
So, what really surprised me when we talked for Between the Covers generally, I think when somebody writes a story, they go in and then they cut. And you're the opposite. You said you kind of start bare bones and then you just add and add. And that's how you approach a story. How are you approaching the novel?
I mean, it's not that different, actually. It's still, as Lydia was saying about everything that she writes is fragments, I feel like the way that I write is just the way that I write, which is sentence to sentence. So there's always this, you know, I'm putting limitations on myself with every turn, because if I don't feel that cordoned off feeling, then I'll freak out and be like, what am I doing? So I just have to be like, okay, it has to only take place in these two places. It has to only be these three characters. It has to only be like every discovery is a limitation or an obstruction, which to me is really helpful to say, this is it. We can't have this friend character because we're already done with characters, not whatever. Because otherwise I feel like I would just go crazy. There's too much on the menu. Yeah. No new friends, no backstory, no memories.
So how do you resolve that in a novel where you could pretty much go anywhere and add as many characters as you like?
It's all just a trick, right? It's all just a way of tricking myself into doing the work and setting up some sort of a to-do list that I can check off, like a comfortable to-do list for me, which to me looks like sinking really deep into one voice. And so that's it for me. So I, as much as people, obviously there's so many ways to do a novel and so many beautiful novels that are polyphonic and have 1,000 narrators, and I just really want one. I want this one voice, and I had to wait to hear it, and now that I've heard it, I can sink into that, and that's it. But then I try not to outline, or which again I don't necessarily know I recommend this for other people, but I sort of like to be as in the dark for as long as possible. I know there's a sort of shape sitting at the center of the story, but that's it, and I'm just working every day totally clueless for years and years.
Now, you said that the stories, you start the story when you've got your first line and often the last line.
Yeah.
And not in between. Has that been true with the novel, too?
I do have an idea of where things end up, if that makes any sense. And at this point, it doesn't at all make any sense. There's no tendril connecting it yet, but that's the daily part. Let's hope. So, yeah.
And Margaret, in People Like You, there's actually three stories that have the same main characters, Bert and Cheryl. Was that something you considered turning into a novel? You had, you know, very strong characters. You had a situation for them where they're trying to get pregnant, and then Cheryl had a miscarriage. In a previous interview, and I don't know if you stopped, but you said you were working on a novel. And that interview, I think, was a few years ago. So,
yeah.
Is that still the case?
So, to answer the first question, I never thought of turning them into a novel. I thought of doing a whole book of short stories about them. And maybe someday, years from now, I will do that. But, yeah, I couldn't write a whole novel. Just, like, they need breathers in between them. They're a tough crew. Tough crew to be around for hundreds of pages. In a wonderful way, because they're very real, I think. In the not a good way. For life, if you're living in life. So,
well, they're also very likable.
They're likable, yeah. But I feel like sometimes they're so unlikably normal that, like, sometimes people read to get away from themselves, and some people read to read about people like themselves. And so, I don't know. That's rambling, but I think it would be. I could not write a novel about them. I hope someday to actually have like an entire collection that is just them. Mm-hmm. But it will probably take my whole life to get that.
And it would be written in short stories.
It would all be short stories. They couldn't. They couldn't have a novel. Oh. I'd drive them off a cliff. I did write a novel after People Like You came out. I wrote a first draft of a novel, and I decided to take everything in terms of the way I wrote, like whatever strategy I had for how I wrote normally for the 15 years before that, I threw it out the window and decided to do everything different to see what would happen and do a novel. And so I wrote the first draft of an awful in about 4 or 5 months, and I think it was really bad. So
are you
going
to continue to work on it?
It's sitting in a drawer. I need to not look at it for a really long time, I think. And I have other ideas now for other novels that I probably will write once this next collection is. I'm like days away from that being done. So when that's done, awesome. I'll probably set forth again. But
oh, congratulations! Yeah. I didn't know about that.
Thanks. Amazing. Yeah, no, like in days. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, it's like the very slender bed, right? It's, I just feel like it's sort of like you get to draw a breath before the waves claim you again.
Totally. Yes.
Now, I want to get into how you guys actually start stories. And you get the voice right. You get that first sentence, Kim, and often the last sentence. And there's other ways. There's characters, maybe Bert and Cheryl. There's setting, Karen with you, Florida, and now the most recent ones, Southeast Portland, which is the title story in Orange World. There's also narrative. Now, Lydia, you said in a previous interview that you actually hear voices.
Damn it.
No. It's not the first writer. And Renee Denfeld told me the same thing. Yeah. And she actually got every single novel she's written from voices. She not only hears the voices, she sees the characters. Her first novel was The Enchanted. And she was leaving a prison that she was visiting, because that's her day job, as an investigator. And she actually saw this man, kind of a scraggly man, sitting right next to her with his bare feet up. She described it in detail, though I begged her not to. It was up on the dashboard. And she got the whole impetus of the novel from that. And you've done the same, because in that same interview, you said that's how you got Dora. You got Joan of Arc, which became the Book of Joan. And you're also working on a Mary Shelley novel, and she appeared to you, too.
Sorry. Renee and I have talked about that. We do have that in common. I have a sort of slightly different origin story in that I was prescribed lithium as a child for auditory hallucination stuff, which they used to do back then, which is hideous, by the way. So I had a condition that was my first experience of this phrase, hearing
that,
voices.
That was not pleasant. Renee's fine with it. I guess she welcomes it, I think.
But where I'm going with it is, as I matured and got help and took care of myself and became an adult, I've come back to the real space and place of hearing voices or seeing things and seeing people, and discovered that artists occupy that space all the time, and there's a place for it, which is the page or the canvas or the musical score or the play. And that's it's a place that's not pathologized by sickness or health. And so when Renee and I have talked about it, it's a joyous thing that we can hear voices or see characters. And so you see what I'm saying? It moved in my life from an extreme trauma and difficulty into the bliss of my life is that I can make art. And I don't feel sick. I feel thrilled to be able to make art. So there's that sad little story. And then the other thing I would add is that I'd throw on the table with everybody else, these other brilliant women writers, that I also watch for the material conditions inhabited by characters or people. And I pay really close attention to those conditions. And so setting for me is puny and stupid. I abandoned setting a long time ago. But material conditions, how can I keep a story embedded within the real conditions of that character's life and not try to transcend it or escape it and make it part of who they are? I would add that to, you know, how do you come up with ideas?
And that's very evident, I think, in The Organ Runner, the story we mentioned.
Her
with
conditions
Anastasia,
are her body. Yes, exactly. You've understood me perfectly, yes. Thank you. I can go now, right?
Well, I just feel privileged to get to read it before it actually goes on sale. It was just a wonderful book. It's funny because I told you that in Facebook Messenger, and you came back with, sorry, it's a buzzkill.
It's a cheery book.
There's not a lot of comfort and very probably no humor in it, really, which is unusual for you.
I think there's some humor, but it's pretty dark humor.
Yeah, pretty dark, because you have a great sense of humor in other work and also personal life.
Well, I think the story with Jesus in it is hilarious, but I'm not certain other people are going to think that about that story. And that's all I'm saying about that.
Well, I didn't find it a buzzkill, though.
I think I just told
you that to me it's art. You took a buzzkill to me is what's going on in the White House now, and
correct. That's obscene.
Yeah, assassinations and some of the cover-ups by the Republicans.
Correct.
I could get into a rant and I won't. But that to me is a buzzkill. That's not art.
Gotcha.
So you took that situation we're all living in and kind of distilled it in these stories.
Thank you.
I want to also talk about point of view. And Kim, you mentioned a preference for first-person present tense. And you said, I like first-person because it puts you in the head right away. You said, I studied with Gordon Lish for many years, and most of the writing he held up as exemplary was in first-person. And Margaret, you have almost the same preference. I think in people like you, every story is pretty much in first-person present tense. There's one second-person present tense.
And I think there's just two, that's first person past tense. Mm-hmm. And you didn't study under Gordon Lish, but you studied under another master teacher, Tom Spanbauer.
Who studied with Gordon.
So it's not that only Gordon Lish.
Gordon Lish does not own first person present tense by any means. But I think I can trace it to that, but it's really just what I like. It's just, I've always, when I start to look at all the stories that have things I like in common, it's that. Or it would be nonfiction, like Chronology of Water, reading something in first person because it's a first person story, and feeling like I'm in the body with that person. And so it's a good, fast way to get there. But also, you know, obviously there's advantages and disadvantages to all the perspectives, but I do have a preference for that. It seems to be the things that I gravitate towards most are first person present tense.
Yeah, and I'm similar. What I prefer to read is often in first person present tense. And I think for reasons that are kind of similar to the dragging down the hallway image that I had in my head before, which is just, and partly it's a cheat. It's like a really fast way to get people on board. If you can embed really quickly with someone, one individual person, it's less work down the line. You just have to do it well. It's not as effective.
Okay, I actually have a quote from you that it's easier to pull the reader in and drag them into what you want to drag them into in first person present tense. I feel like I have you. I really have someone by the hand.
I'm so violent. I had no idea. At least you didn't say by the hair. I'm learning about myself.
That'd be a little more painful.
For it. Absolutely for it.
And Lydia, you didn't study directly with Tom. You weren't part of the Dangerous Writers.
We are writerly friends. His partner has done all the ink on my body.
I've seen the mermaid tattoo.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's the only man I would let write on my body.
It's extremely well done, very
artistic.
And his
work has been deeply impactful on my work, but I was never a student of his.
Well, your writing group, there were several people there who studied directly under him. Chuck Palahniuk, Susie Vitello, Monica Drake.
Yep.
So how would you describe Tom's influence on your work? And you use both varying points of view.
Yeah, I can't hold on to a first person to save my life. Not even
Karen's
my own
the same
memoirs.
Way.
So it isn't so much that attracts me personally, but the lyricism inside Tom.